show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to Majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It's Thursday, August 9th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks, and I'm Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Brian Meyer of Brazil Wire, election approaching in Brazil in October. Lula still in prison, but a new strategy from his party. We'll talk about what's happening in Brazil, its regional and global implications, and a path forward for restoring democracy and broadening rights. Also, Fox News and the Trump administration, they're getting even more overt about white nationalism, if that was even remotely possible. Well, Laura Ingraham is showing us how. Mike Pompeo is telling the North Koreans to cut their arsenal by between 60 and 70%, as apparently the far-right Secretary of State is the detail guy on the North Korea deal, even as the administration promises a ramp up of catastrophic and dangerous sanctions against Iran. Representative Chris Collins, who was indicted on insider trading, well, you know what he was really up to? Trying to decrease human suffering through innovation and the market, obviously. Speaking of innovation, Kris Kobach, the Secretary of State of Kansas, he's not going to recuse himself in the recount in his Republican primary. So that's interesting. Just want to remind everybody that the guy has built his whole career on nativist, racist conspiracy theories about voter fraud. Interesting. New York City Council passes the first in the nation cap on Uber and Lyft, including a minimum wage for the car share companies. Jim Brune has withdrawn from the Sinclair merger, saying that it will sue for breach of contract. Ajit Pai getting skittish. And Gary Cohn has some thoughts about social media and social media companies that is such a stupid comparison that it will make you defend them for one split second. And new research shows that, yes, in the very rare instances where there are punishments for free speech on campuses, guess who it affects, everybody? Well, if you're watching the show and you know anything, you would probably correctly anticipate that the answer is left-wingers. And also, we have just depressing news on Puerto Rico to get to. All of that and more on today's Majority Report. Brendan on the boards.
Ones and twos.
Brendan's on the ones and twos.
You forgot to say free Jordan Peterson.
Free Jordan Peterson as part of the ongoing increase of tensions between Saudi Arabia and Canada. The Saudis have found their Sultanitsyn of Canada. It's funny. I'm sure Peterson has said screw, or I assume he said some screw.
I'm defenseless against that kind of female insanity.
Exactly. That is an Arabic proverb.
Peterson has actually said free Raif Badawi, so.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure he has.
I missed that part.
Oh, yeah. Is that really true?
It is true, yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, good for him. Good for Jordan Peterson. All right, well, you took like 30%. Out of the cut we're going to get into him on later.
Yeah, exactly. You but still made Saudi Arabia think you were a political prisoner by your nonsense about, you know, pronouns.
This is true. The man said that the woman should not be a man, and then he was put in prison. Canada is a den of snakes and liars. Speaking of a den of snakes and liars, and I think that transition actually does work in all sorts of ways, Fox News. Remember when Laura Ingraham did that weird arm motion thing at the Republican National Committee in 2016? I don't know, guys. I'm sorry. I'm just thinking of this. It's totally spontaneous. So if you don't have it, don't worry about it because we didn't plan on it. Oh, okay. We do have it. Nice.
You mean the Ingraham angle or the Ingraham angle?
The Ingraham angle.
It's about 30 degrees, maybe 40, about, a little bit yeah. short of 45.
I'm not saying it was an intentional angle, but I'm suggesting it was. I'm heavily implying it was. I'm saying it certainly has, if people are looking at this, this angle has, shall we say, historical echoes. It was a body posture that was reminiscent of a certain group of people.
It was oh so fleeting.
Oh so fleeting. Dad would have been so proud. Laura Ingraham is just, I mean, she's somebody that in any rightly functioning society would be sort of begging some local FM outlet that was going under, to let her have a white nationalist hour, in between. I don't even know. I can't even think any profession I could think of that Laura Ingraham should be doing is an insult to that profession. So I won't even use an example. Here's Laura Ingraham, and it should be, you know, put in context of something I'm sure that we're going to be covering more, but there's a lot of reporting, I believe it was an NBC report, and a lot of reporting indicating that the next wave of the ethnic cleansing war on people of color by the Republican Party in America is going to target, quote unquote, legal immigrants. I'll put that in quotation marks, just as I won't say illegal either. But immigrants who are here, who have done the paperwork. And the policy proposal is essentially that if you have ever benefited from any government program, anything from Obamacare to food stamps, so of course this would implicate, you know, pretty much all Americans, you could be subject to deportation even if all of your work is here in order and you've been here for quite some time, obviously. That's in the pipeline. And of course, that's the real agenda of these people, some for ideological reasons, some for just engineering an electoral map that favors Republicans. This is Laura Ingraham, the sort of with a letting the next phase of white nationalist propaganda out of the bag here, setting the stage for what we'll see probably around October, November from the administration.
Because in some parts of the country, it does seem like the America that we know and love doesn't exist anymore. Massive demographic changes have been foisted upon the American people. And they're changes that none of us ever voted for and most of us don't like. From Virginia to California, we see stark examples of how radically, in some ways, the country has changed. Now, much of this is related to both illegal and in some cases, legal immigration that, of course, progressives love.
We love that. Actually, I do. I enjoy living in a more interesting, more broad-based society. But that's actually pretty irrelevant to the conversation here. The conversation is about rights and norms, racism versus not racism, and universal delivery and delivery and equity for everybody. So, and by the way, this is absolutely an area where there is a zero-sum game fight. There's no question in my mind that some in certain areas of the tensions around these issues could absolutely be influenced and impacted by addressing the structural inequality issues and issues of capitalism we have in this country. I just have no doubt about that. And I know that we need to deal with those issues regardless. And I also know that there is a group of people, of which Laura Ingraham and Donald Trump and every single Republican leader in Congress is a part of, who want a white ethnostate of a strong or soft variety. Maybe some people don't want to sort of legally resegregate the country. Maybe they just want, you know, a sort of generally white place where everybody kind of informally, quote unquote, knows their place. Okay. And you won't have to be shocked by you know, somebody speaking Spanish by you or whatever other nonsense that these idiots get up to. And then there's people who clearly are and in real positions of influence and power who are absolutely closer to a overt legislative white ethno state end of things. And that, yes, that's a zero sum game. Those people need to be absolutely destroyed politically. They need to be completely discredited culturally. And they need to, in people in our positions, be mocked, undermined, and destroyed in every cultural way, shape, and form. Period. And then in the civic space, that's where people like Kristen Piccolini and others can, you know, work on the emotional, psychological, cultural things and, you know, and barriers that we're going to need to overcome to deal with these issues on the ground. But as a matter of politics, the inequality will influence it. And then there's just a whole bunch of people that are showing us the ball here who we need to destroy. There isn't even a subtext to untangle in that segment. She said it. And that's the enemy. So let's be on it.
This is the time.
That's
And always remember to just don't let these people walk this horse back into the barn in two, 3 years when they're talking about taxes and whistling it again instead of just saying this quiet part loud. You always have to remember these things.
Precisely. And look, I'm not, you know, obviously that Rick Wilson, never Trump guy, you know, I'm not particularly enamored of him. I'll give him credit for staying on that beat when a lot of other people have either sort of quieted down or admitted that, you know, giving money to rich people is more important to them than all the other things they found uncouth about Trump. He stayed on that beat because apparently, you know, to his credit, Trump's, you know, racism and just being disgusting is sort of generally repulsive to him. But he actually said the other day in an interview, he said, you know, what he, and I'm paraphrasing him obviously, but he's like recognizing that, like, unfortunately, that, you know, a lot of Republicans are happy that they don't have to subtext this anymore. They're happy that they can give into their id on this stuff. And, you know, of course, part of me is like, yeah, dude, we know. So why the fuck were you working to get them elected across the country? But that being said, I mean, again, you know, credit where credit is due for being real about what's happening here.
Because most people actually, there's a reason they have to pretend, right?
Right.
Because they need that chunk of people. And there are enough, but now they're realizing that, okay, we've kind of maybe hit diminishing returns with those people. There's all these other people we've been neglecting with couching these things in softer terms that we can make up for. And I think it is it's definitely a short-term desperation play because I think most people don't like this stuff.
I don't think they do either. And I think that that is a good – I think that, of course, you know, these issues are very complex and there's a massive amount of, you know, bias and racism across the board. But one way in which, yes, I agree with you. I think most people, including people who might be pretty bad on some issues and might possess some very unhelpful attitudes and there might be work to do or whatever, but in a functional political sense, yeah, I don't think most normal people like this stuff. And I think even when we looked at that Trump focus group, there was, you know, there was the guy who apologized for voting for Trump, and there was also that middle-aged white dude who was just like, why'd he call LeBron stupid? And, you know, again, we could say like, hey, buddy, like, what were you listening to the whole campaign? And that's a fair point. But at the same time, great. If it takes the LeBron tweet to get it and he's going to flip and vote the right way and he sees things clearly, awesome. Welcome aboard, at least for this specific battle.
And my point is, like, often it's not really the what they call the inciting event, like a LeBron tweet. It's really right. How that event is received in their social groups. And so that guy probably has friends that are like Cavs fans or something. I don't know. They have season tickets, right? Like, it could be something as petty as that.
Totally.
And I think that's why in the long term, it's better to be a good person and not racist and those sort and for the people, because
right.
I think it does. I think people actually do come. I don't think people are walking away from the left. I think people are walking away maybe to like apathy. That's what the right wants. If
that's what they want.
Right, right.
I don't think most people respond to a bunch of ghouls and sociopaths, monsters and unhinged idiots ranting and raving about, you know, community leaders and athletes and defending kidnapping children and putting them in cages. Most normal people don't respond to that. And that does speak well of them. And yes, if you're on the left, you must have a broad optimism about people. All right, we are going to be right back with Brian Mayer from the Brazil Wire on the Majority Report. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Brian Mayer. Brian Mayer, he is the editor of the Brazil Wire, an editor for Brazil Wire, and he's an American who's resided in Brazil for 22 years. Brian, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Michael. How's it going?
It's going really well. I'm glad to be talking with you. People who watch or listen to me on Majority Report or watch and listen to me on the Michael Brooks Show know that I am a very attentive follower of Brazil, a strong supporter of Lula, somebody who was also a big admirer. I think the case of Marielle Franco is also incredibly important, and I think that Brazil is important in and of itself, and I think that the dynamics playing out there are, you know, parallel a lot of other very important situations in the world today. And I've really appreciated your work and help sort of orienting me to what's going on the ground there. So thank you for being here. So let's work backwards a little bit. There's a context for what's happening in Brazil, but let's start with the events of really the past week. What did Lula's Workers Party decide to do with regards to nominating him for president, which he still leads in the polls, and a so-called plan B if the courts still thwart him? What's the electoral play that the Workers Party has come up with?
Okay, well, we're currently living in kind of a state of exception in terms of law, and the law has been manipulated in all kinds of ways. And so the electoral courts pulled a maneuver last week requiring all parties to report who their vice president would be early. And they gave this order out like on Sunday so that all parties had to come up with a vice president on their ticket by midnight Sunday night. And so the PT's strategy,
which is the Workers now, Party, just to tell
people. Yeah, the Workers, sorry. Yeah.
No problem. PT is okay. Workers Party. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, their strategy has been to wait until the last possible moment to register Lula's candidacy, because for his candidacy to be barred, it's going to take a while in the court systems. And so the longer that they wait to register, the bigger the chance that they won't be able to cancel his candidacy until after the elections, which would be a big problem for the conservatives. So they had this pressure put on them, and they came up with the idea that they would announce former São Paulo mayor Fernando Haddad as his vice president candidate, with a stipulation that if he's allowed to run officially when he registers on the 15th of August, he'll change his vice president candidate to communist state senator from Rio Grande do Sul, Manuela Dávila. And if he's not allowed to run, then Haddad will be the presidential candidate and Manuela Dávila will be the vice presidential candidate for him. So either way you look at it, Manuela Dávila will be the VP candidate.
And she's of the Communist Party in Brazil. So what does this move say about the kind of – because there's also – you know, the other sort of understanding I have of Brazil is that the left has been very fractured and Lula is kind of generally – you know, I mean, first of all, he's the most popular politician in the country and he also seems to be the one that can kind of generally unite the left, do the best job of that. So – what does this sort of triple play say about the left unifying and specifically the role of the Communist Party with the Workers' Party in this climate of, you know, being outside of the rule of law, essentially?
Okay, first of all, there's this kind of myth in the North that Lula fragmented the left party and that the left was being really divided, but it's not really true. If you look back, there's one political party that's been making a lot of noise about the left being fragmented in the past, which is called PSOL. It's the Socialism and Liberty Party. But this is their electoral rhetoric, because inside of Congress, they always sided with the PT. And now their presidential candidate is openly supporting Lula's right to run. And the left is more united than it's been in like 20 years at this point. That being said, the Brazilian Communist Party is not really a radical left party. They're center left. They're like social democrats, even though, I mean, they're not arguing about seizing the means of production and creating a dictatorship of the proletariat or anything. They're talking about, you know, more funding for education and better public health system. So despite their name, they're essentially a solid center left political party that has its roots in a big labor union federation called the CTB and in the National Residents Association Confederation, which is the second largest urban social movement in Brazil. So they have a strong base. They're a medium-sized party, and they've been pretty faithful to the PT for the last 30 years, you know, although they do have their roots in the armed struggle against the military dictatorship. During the dictatorship, they were a Maoist guerrilla organization.
That's fascinating. So we're going to get back. We're going to get to the roots of this in a second. But just on the final note, obviously, Lula has been in prison for several months. The Brazilian media has drastically limited his ability to communicate to the general public, which even in and of itself is odd. I mean, this is my understanding is, you know, sometimes in Brazil, as an example, people who've, you know, headed like drug cartels could do a TV interview from prison. They've not allowed Lula to communicate. But through, you know, his meetings with his lawyers and others and sort of mapping strategy for the party and also what Haddad has said, as well as Manuela, what kind of issues are they talking about, both in terms of, I would assume, running against austerity, but are they also talking about taking on some of the structural issues in Brazil, like media concentration that helped sort of, you know, lead this sort of right wing, coup, I guess we could call it, going back for the last several years. Some of the areas that were more fundamental and structural in Brazilian society and Brazilian oligarchy that weren't put into play before. Are they talking about that?
Yeah, yes, they are. The big battle right now is, and all of the left and center-left parties are saying the same thing, that are running candidates, is to revert the privatizations and structural adjustments that were pushed through after the 2016 coup. The Brazilian left is unanimous in calling what happened in 2016 a coup. And the top issue is this: reverting the neoliberal reforms that were made to workers' rights, and reverting the privatization of the Petrobras Petroleum Company and undoing the constitutional amendment that was passed, freezing public health and education spending for 20 years. So that's the top issue. However, Fernando Haddad gave a press conference yesterday, and he was talking about this issue with media concentration and the media oligarchies. Now, you know, you can make a lot of criticism about the PT governments, and a lot of members of PT themselves are very critical of their own government. They never had more than 22% of Congress. And so it's a different situation than the U.S. where you have a president and he has a majority vote. They always had to try and get things done by coalitions. And one of their biggest mistakes was not trying to break up the media monopolies. And, you know, everyone realizes this now. And so Haddad was talking about this yesterday. And it's not just a question of breaking up monopolies. The big media companies in Brazil receive funding from the federal government, a lot of funding in advertising money. And this is something that Globo Television Organization is the biggest media organization in Brazil. It's one of the biggest open-air TV networks in the world. After the coup, President Michel Temer increased funding for them by like 50%. Mm. And they receive millions and millions of dollars a year from the government. The least that PT could do, or any left candidate who wins the election in October could do, would be to stop giving them so much money.
Right. Stop subsidizing the opposition.
Subsidized.
Let's first we'll get to the events, I think, you know, starting maybe in 2014 and Dilma's government and this anti-corruption drive and get into that. But looping back to the beginning for a minute, let's talk about Lula's time in office, because one of the things that's striking to me about it, as you said, that both for very practical reasons in terms of their ability to maneuver parliament, the concentrations of power in Brazilian society and politics, and also it seems, and maybe in some ways, you know, Lula's own instincts, this is not at all a radical government. It was, in my read, an incredibly successful social democratic one that did seriously improve a lot of people's lives. And Lula obviously has an incredibly unique political talent. But it was not something that, you know, plenty of oligarchs could have been satisfied. And in fact, many of them did incredibly well in the Lula years because commodity prices were booming. The BRIC nations were incredibly well positioned in that kind of 2003 to 2010 period, even during the economic meltdown. Is that read right? I mean, what was Lula's presidency actually like? And why would these people be so, I mean, is it just like in the United States, even the most moderate, you know, centrist Obama style kind of approach freaks out the right wing billionaire class? I mean, what is it?
Okay, I think your assessment is correct. You know, I lived here during that entire time. This idea that, like, Lula betrayed the left, it's perpetrated by these kind of radical vanguard leftist intellectuals. You know? Right. But the fact is, the PT pretty much disassociated itself from being a radical left party in the early 1990s. And Lula sent a letter to the Brazilian people about 8 months before the elections, in which he explained, this government is not going to be that far left. I have to deal with the international financial institutions if I'm going to get elected. So everyone knew. And he went up and met with the people at the World Bank and the IMF and told them that he wasn't going to default on their loans, you know, before he ran for office to placate the markets. If he hadn't done that, he wouldn't have been allowed to take the presidency. And so he started with a government that was trapped into these conditionality agreements because of IMF loans that Fernando Henrique Cardoso had taken out. And in 2005, he paid back all of the loans. Him and Nestor Kirchner announced on the same day that they were paying back all their loans to the IMF. And the next day, the IMF had to lay off around 2,000 people, because they were making so much money off of these loans.
Right.
Okay. So at that point, he swung to the left farther, you know, because with the conditionality agreements over, he was able to drastically increase social spending. So he increased money for the education and health systems. He created an affirmative action system that's based on social class more than race, which is quadruple the number of black students in federal universities. And he doubled the number of students in free public national universities while quadrupling the minimum salary. So he did a lot of things. He wasn't like a Obama-style character at all.
Right.
He was solidly social democrat, but not radical left. You know, they maintained some neoliberal policies macroeconomically, like a floating exchange rate and an independent central bank that pleased the people up in the north. You know, and this is why at the time you had The Economist praising Lula and Obama and people like that, because they considered Brazil to be and Argentina to be positive examples as alternatives to Hugo Chavez in Venezuela for other Latin American nations to follow. They were really trying to isolate Chavez. So the minute Chavez died, it looks like they just turned on all of the center-left governments in Latin America. And you have this rolling back of the pink tide that Mark Weisbrot is talking about this last week on Real News, about how all of the center-left and left governments in Latin America are being forced out of office with U.S. collaboration.
So that's an interesting thing. Yeah, we'll get to that in the second and car wash. But yeah, so that there was a truth, obviously, that as an example, Lula and Chavez followed very different politics, and there was a social democratic and a more, I don't know how you define Chavez. I mean, I'm still confused as to how to define Chavez's politics, to be honest. But there were different politics at stake. The United States was trying to pivot them against each other, but inside the region, it seemed like all of these governments, I mean, they weren't, I mean, Lula wasn't trying to be in conflict with Chavez, at least not, you know, overtly. I mean, it seemed that they all had a sort of acceptance that we're all sort of were doing. I mean, I just read an excerpt from Castro's, a recent Castro autobiography, which is sort of just spoken word interviews with an interviewer. And he praised Lula. And he said, you know, obviously Lula's on a totally different path than us, but, you know, he's cutting poverty. He's, you know, he's combating racism in Brazil. He's bringing healthcare to people. Like, this is part of our same mission. And it seemed that those governments were actually able to recognize their alliance themselves in spite of that sort of attempt to pit.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Yeah. You're exactly right. The attempt to pit, you know, to hold up Argentina and Brazil as a positive example to Chavez did not work in Latin America. All of the left Latin American governments formed alliances together. They met, they talked a lot together. And it comes down to this concept from Gramsci, who was a big influence on the PT party, which is the idea that the left, if the left is going to take power in a capitalist system and through a democracy, it has to build counter-hegemony. And so Lula felt like he was an ally to Venezuela and Cuba in the sense that there is a big effort underway in Latin America to create a counter-hegemony to American hegemony, you know, to show that there, you didn't have to follow the Washington consensus to build society in Latin America. And this was a thorn in the side of the United States, obviously.
Very much so, and including in its more, you know, sort of herbivorous varieties. Every time I talk about Brazil, I'll get, I do get a lot of appreciation from people in Brazil who follow, you know, this type of media in the United States and appreciate it. But there's always, whether it's on Twitter or elsewhere, you know, usually the sort of, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. You know, Lula and PT were part of, were both, you know, massively corrupt and so on. And it did seem that there, I mean, there was this car wash investigation that started and this sort of free floating corruption rhetoric starting, if I'm correct, in about 2014. Dilma Rousseff is Lula's successor. She's actually a really fascinating and in many ways impressive figure in her own right, but not as politically adroit as him, and maybe and was, you know, dealing with a totally different global economy. And then, you know, this thing called car wash comes along. So what is car wash? And again, with some, you know, let's also have objectivity here. I mean, did it implicate members of the Workers' Party? Like, what are the actual charges and the specifics, and what did it reveal? And in fact, as you alluded to before, what was the U.S. role?
Okay, well, I'm glad you asked this question. It all starts basically, you can go back to 2002, 2003 with Otto Reich, the Cold Warrior, Cuban State Department, Cuban American, you know, talking about corruption being the new enemy in Latin America in general. But really, it starts in 2009. In 2009, Hillary Clinton appeared on C-SPAN and said, democracy in Latin America is not enough. The United States has to work to strengthen independent judiciaries in Latin America. That year, according to cables that were leaked through WikiLeaks, there was a conference in Brazil called Bridge to the Future, in which Judge Sergio Moro was a key speaker, in which U.S. Department of Justice officials and Brazilian judiciary talked about setting up partnerships to combat corruption in Brazil. And they suggested in these leaked documents that Curitiba would be the city where this could happen. Okay, during the years that followed, it was uncovered by Snowden that the NSA was spying on the Brazilian petroleum company Petrobras.
Right.
Around 2014, as you said, this investigation started up called Operation Car Wash, which is a joint investigation between the U.S. Department of Justice, the FBI, the SEC, and the Brazilian Public Prosecutor's Office and Federal Police. But what's funny about it is it's a small branch of the Prosecutor's Office and the judiciary based in Curitiba, led by this judge named Sergio Moro. Okay, so they uncovered a lot of corruption, which is not hard to do, you know, in the private sector, especially in the petroleum and the construction industries, which are two of the five most corrupt industries in the world.
Right.
I'm from Chicago, you know, where you don't even have a bidding process for public construction projects. And, you know, if you scratch under the surface in construction in Chicago, you're going to find all kinds of corruption going on. Right. So it's not that this corruption isn't happening, but they failed to, you know, they've uncovered all kinds of things like on audio tapes and videotapes of top officials from other political parties receiving bribes. And in one case, 2014 presidential candidate Ercio Neves threatening to kill a witness.
Right.
You know, these guys are all free. But they managed to find one person talking about this apartment that Lula allegedly received reforms on. And this is how the case was built against Lula. What's interesting about it is that in 2009, the U.S. Department of Justice set up a case against Senator Ted Stevens in Alaska, alleging that he had received illegal reforms from an oil company on his house. And this caused him to lose the election, re-election. And then the Department of Justice was, the entire case was reversed, and members of the DOJ were accused of prosecutorial misconduct for violating Brady law. In other words, hiding evidence that's beneficial to the defense, of relying entirely on plea bargain testimony by unreliable witnesses, et cetera, et cetera. The case against Lula is very similar to the Ted Stevens case. That in this case, they weren't even able to prove that he ever owned or set foot in this apartment. Then after he was arrested, a squatters movement led by presidential candidate Guilherme Boulos invaded the apartment and filmed and showed that no reforms had ever taken place there. You know, like, so.
And when, also, I just want to really underline that this case hinges on the notion that he took this seaside apartment, which, by the way, I mean, I guess, you know, not that this is a very second order point, but it's not like this is a middle class apartment. This is not like some type of ostentatious, you know, ultra exclusive C villa. This is something totally, you know, I mean, it's, you know, it's Brazil. It's beautiful. It's by the beach. But it's, you know, it's a high rise building of, you know, economy apartments. There's nothing luxury or high-end about it. And there's nothing from at least the visible physical evidence to even sort of implicate anybody even ever living or spending time there. Now, I guess theoretically, I mean, you could still own a place and not set foot in it and expect to use it in the future or whatever. But this of an investigation that has exposed, I believe, what you mean, you mentioned several examples. I believe there's also an example of Michel Temer, the president who the impeachment of Dilma, you know, took her position, of him on tape talking about bribing people. It is exposed a massive amount of misconduct. Most of the most extreme examples of which have come from the political right and from the private sector. And somehow the most tenuous example has jailed the most popular and successful politician in the country's history.
Yeah, it's a farce. It's a judicial farce. And that's not just my opinion. That's what Jeffrey Robertson, Queen's counsel and human rights lawyer from the UN, says about this case, which is why it's under review from the UN Human Rights Committee. But just to your point about the apartment is absolutely correct. It's not a very fancy apartment. On top of that, they were unable to prove he ever owned or set foot in it. But even if he had, the dates that they say he received this apartment were after he left office. So what if someone gave him an apartment after he was president? There's no way to prove that there was any conflict of interest because he was retired.
Right.
You know, but in any event, there's no proof that he received it, which is why his official sentence, his official charges are for committing undetermined acts. They couldn't even specify what he did in the sentence, which is what makes it such a farce, really.
He's literally in jail for what they're deeming undetermined acts.
Yes.
They related to
related to anything, because there's all this misinformation in the New York Times and the Guardian and these fake liberal publications up in the north. If you can't determine the act, you can't relate it to anything.
Precisely. Right.
You can't even say what it was. So how could you relate it to anything?
Right. And if you read any coverage of him, they will literally write he's in jail for sometimes they'll just outright say corruption, which is mind blowing. And then other times they'll say indeterminate acts related to car wash, which is, you know, indeterminate acts related to ordering dinner. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the day that the week that Lula was arrested, The Guardian ran an article saying that he was being arrested for allegedly receiving bribes as part of an 88 million real influence peddling deal with Petrobras Petroleum Company. In the actual sentence, Judge Morrow says there's no relationship whatsoever with Petrobras. So my feeling is that these journalists who are writing about Lula's arrest and conviction have not read the actual sentence.
Right.
And, it's a 300, 200 and whatever page sentence in archaic legal Portuguese, but they haven't read it. So they're just repeating what they see in these right-wing media oligarchies down here. Nobody's doing the actual job of reporting and trying to figure out if what the prosecution is saying is correct or not.
And also, right, and just to really put a pin in this, and the Supreme Court jailed him before his appeal process has gone through. He still has appeals should he choose to pursue them. He's pursued some. I think he's stopped a certain appeal for technical reasons related to his candidacy for president. But that's what they jailed him on. He's the leading presidential candidate in an October election. The second candidate behind him is an overt fascist, and he has been jailed before his appeals have run out and completely excommunicated from public life, based on exactly the case that Brian just outlined. And that is why people call this a judicial coup, and that's why there's such important implications of it. Briefly, can you explain, though, the sort of dramatic arc of 2016? What was the impeachment process of Dilma? Because Dilma has said explicitly that this is a two-step, that the right wing had lost four elections in a row to PT, first under Lula, then under her. And they decided, we're going to get rid of her. We're going to implement an austerity regime. which obviously the United States will be happy with. And then the next step is making sure Lula can't run again, because again, he's the most popular politician in the country. So can you, we've actually, I think, explained Lula pretty well in the current situation, but what was the situation with Dilma? Because that in some ways is even, I mean, it would be like, I don't know, impeaching Obama for an accounting error or something. I mean, maybe explain that.
Yeah. Well, basically when Dilma won the election, the re-election in 2014, there was a massive narrative shift in the northern media trying to portray Brazil as like a losing country. Right. And so after she won the election in 2014, this same Operation Car Wash team began to sabotage the economy. They froze all of the operations. They paralyzed operations of the five biggest construction companies in Brazil, causing 500,000 immediate job layoffs in 2015. And there's an article that ran in BBC down here that said that these maneuvers caused 2.7% of the 3.4% drop in GDP in 2015. So the economy was destabilized. Then the media started reporting all of these allegations that Dilma was involved in corruption with the Petrobras state petroleum company. I mean, I even saw John Oliver, you know, talking about it, you know, not knowing what he's talking about. So there's no, right. So there was no evidence whatsoever that she was connected to any kind of corruption in Petrobras. None. That was never even brought onto the table. She was never accused of that, even though her name was associated with this in the New York Times, something like in 20 articles the year before the coup, right? So she was finally put up on impeachment for committing a budgetary infraction, which is not an impeachable offense in Brazil, called fiscal peddling. This is an infraction that's commonly used by all the mayors and the governors that just involves shifting values around in different ministries of your government to appear that one department isn't in the red or in the black, right. You know? And it's often done before elections and whatever. The key point here, though, is that she was exonerated from these charges after the impeachment happened. And the week after the impeachment, the Senate legalized fiscal peddling. It's not even a crime anymore.
Right.
You know. And then evidence came out that Eduardo Cunha and Temer were paying congressmen to vote in favor of the impeachment.
Right.
And so I find it ironic that newspapers like The Guardian and New York Times and Washington Post still, when they refer to this process, say the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, which some people refer to as a coup. Because if she was thrown out of office for something that's not legal justification for impeachment, then it was a coup. I mean, it was illegal. The process was illegal. And if you look at the havoc that her successors have wreaked on Brazilian society, where Brazil's returning to the UN's World Hunger Map, extreme poverty has doubled in the last 2 years, you know, crime's going through the roof, unemployment's going through the roof. You see, it was brutal. The effects of it, it's not that some people in Brazil are calling this a coup. It's unanimous right. on the left that this was a coup. Some people are calling it a form of warfare. You know, this is a kind of low-intensity war against Brazil.
Yeah. No, that's certainly how I view it. Is there more momentum now? I mean, there was a whole other drama, which maybe we'll get into in another conversation, which, you know, also underlined just the farcical nature of this. I mean, the deadly serious and horrifying nature of this, but the farcical nature of one judge ordering Lula to be released, Judge Moro refusing to comply with the order, hundreds of thousands of people flooding on the streets expecting Lula's release, that being overturned. One part of me, and I'll just set the table for this last question, you know, is very, I mean, legally it seems incredibly a pessimistic situation because obviously the courts are, you know, highly complicit in this process. And they've obviously, you know, the jailing and silencing of Lula speaks for itself. And it's, you know, and their role in this process. On the other hand, it seems, you know, the left is converging. Lula is still the most important and leading presidential candidate. And maybe there's a chance here. I mean, what's your kind of read on the situation heading into October?
Well, you know, if they're free elections, first of all, they're not free elections if Lula's not allowed to run.
Right.
That's a fact.
Right.
Even so, if they don't invent a way to just cancel the PT's candidacy entirely, you know, I think that, well, for example, right now, Lula's popularity is higher than all other candidates combined.
Right.
You know, there's some states like Bahia where he's got 82% support. So if the elections actually happen, the PT, with or without Lula, is going to win. There's no doubt about that. The question is, will they happen properly or not? And this is a big worry. I published a book of interviews last year called Voices of the Brazilian Left, and a lot of the people from the social movements and unions I spoke to are really worried that they're going to invent a reason to cancel the elections, you know, to just say this time around the Senate will appoint the president. So this all depends on the pressure on the street, and there's a lot of big protests underway. If enough pressure can build up, if the unions start striking, there's going to be a national day of paralyzation on August 10th, which is tomorrow, actually.
Yes.
And tomorrow, a protest process is going to start across the nation for 5 days, culminating in Brasilia, when tens of thousands of people are going to surround the Supreme Electoral Court and demand that they allow Lula to register his candidacy. So a lot of the success of the left, which is united now, in taking back power and undoing the damage caused by the coup, depends on people on the street. You know, so I personally hope that it happens.
And I guess even potentially in an optimistic scenario, if this victory is achieved and, you know, there is a PT government, that same momentum and harnessing of street energy could also change the character, you know, and 'cause even just for practical reasons, a more leftward government this time around to take on things like those media monopolies and other, you know, structural oligarchies and police violence and so on, because not only because it's the right thing to do, but because obviously they pose a structural threat to even successful social democracy that's praised by The Economist.
Yeah, well, I hope so. If Lula's elected, he's going to be farther left this time around,
right?
Because they're doing it without conservative coalition partners.
Yeah.
This time, you know, if he's not elected and Haddad is elected, I have a feeling they might try and placate the right a little bit. It might be a little bit more of a moderate government, but still undoing the privatizations of Petrobras and undoing the constitutional amendment freezing at health and education spending. But my hope is that Lula's allowed to run and he wins.
That's certainly my hope as well. Brian Mayer, I really appreciate your time. Everybody should read Brazil Wire for the best, some of the best independent reporting, analysis, and insight from Brazil, the Brazilian left. Brian, sure I'll be talking with you again sometime soon. I appreciate your time.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. All right, folks. I think the parallels there are actually very clear with the United States in a lot of ways. Including, I actually was just watching a Vice documentary on the rise of these really reactionary and evangelical movements and how they're sort of overlapping with this resurgent fascist right in Brazil and trying to capitalize on the attempted destruction of the left.
It's amazing how all this stuff is always, it seems to be globally synchronized. Yeah. Ira Katznelson wrote a book called Fear Itself about this sort of thing coalescing, sort of authoritarianism coalescing in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And we're just, it is like a global sort of virus almost.
Yeah. Well, right-wing authoritarianism is the herpes of capitalism, the really vivid, disgusting, but absolutely perfect phrase by Bill Fletcher Jr. Brendan, what were you going to say?
It's globalist.
It's globalist. I mean, I do think that somebody like, yeah, I mean, it's if you got a President Lula back into office in Brazil, just even have, I mean, first and foremost, obviously stopping the emergency and the warfare on the Brazilian people. But I do think that none of this can happen without mass mobilization and social movements. But at the same time, there's, you know, leaders also matter. And if you think about a world where it's an uphill struggle, but you have, wait a second, maybe in a couple of years, instead of a Bolsonaro, who's a fascist, being president of Brazil, or some horrible technocrat mediocrity, Lula's back in office. And then Corbyn's in office. Sanders is in office. And AMLO's in office. I mean, not to idealize these people, or not to say there aren't conditions that need to support them in doing the right thing, but that's a much more formidable, much more positive. I mean, if you can't see the massive difference there, I don't know what to tell you.
And I think part of the reason is the right sees a massive difference there. Exactly. And that's why they're doing all this thing.
And that's why the right, and that's the point to really underline with Lula is that, I mean, we see it in the United States. The United States, the right goes out of its way to destroy even conservative, corporate-friendly Democrats. In Brazil, you had a president who, partially because of very favorable global conditions, literally generate, like, that would be the equivalent of take some, and obviously Brazil starts with way more poverty, way more complexity, and so on. But, like, that was Scandinavia and Brazil to the extent it could happen. He produced a successful social democracy that in no way, in fact, the traditional elites got richer, and they're still doing this, which says a lot about the need, not just morally, but practically, to reclaim structural power, because they won't even allow that. And that, in some ways, is why I am not, you know, people, I'm not into the minutiae of this stuff, but, like, one of the reasons I'm not just a social democrat, and I'm much more serious about putting much larger amounts of the economy and democratizing them, putting them under government control, is because I see that even a situation like that, that was in fact a pure win-win, they're still not happy with.
Yeah, I mean, I'll speak for Jamie here. I think there is an inevitable psychopathy or yep. sociopathy of yeah. capitalism.
Yes. Yeah, she's totally right about that. All right, folks, obviously, become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Click on the support page of the majority.fm homepage. That's how this show happens. That's how we stay independent. It's a cliche to mention it, but I mean, honestly, where else are you going to get that kind of conversation?
You want to give it to the Washington Post, who just let Palmer Luckey write an op-ed? Did you see this?
No.
Palmer Luckey wrote an op-ed saying, hey, if tech wants to protect Americans or something like that, they should work better with the military.
Right.
Palmer Luckey, the guy who created Oculus, but was kicked off of that project after it was outed that he was basically a sponsor for 4chan MAGA fascists.
Hashtag resistance.
Democracy dies in the darkness.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't want the New York Times or Washington Post to collapse, but if you think that your subscription to those sites are doing any type, I mean, they need to be there. They're a vital part of the ecosystem. But if you think editorially and big picture, they're doing anything to rein in, even frankly, Trump, let alone the excesses and the context that give rise to Trump, you're delusional. You do need to look at this program and others like it. We're doing that work.
Yeah, independent or local, I don't think you should subscribe to. I don't think you should give money to those papers. I think they'll be fine.
I think they'll be totally fine. I agree with you entirely. Independent or local, and of course, Majority Report, big part of that. We appreciate all your support. The Michael Brooks Show is an emerging part of that, and we appreciate your support. This Sunday for patrons, Gene Bajelon and I untangled the Jeremy Corbyn anti-Semitism and the Labor Party story and went into, again, also some of the kind of synchronized global implications of that. That was for patrons. Of course, Woke Bros with Woz for patrons. And each Tuesday we do a full, segmented, really, really good show that's global. It's entertaining. There's a lot going on. Next Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, there's going to be a substitute super producer. So pretty exciting show coming up there. And then, of course, we have our new – we've already cracked 5K on our new YouTube channel.
He's crushing.
Crushing it. Get to the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel. Similar, I think, obviously, between that, Majority Report, Antifa, Literary Hangover, and any number of other great, you know, independent voices, you got a great diet there. That YouTube page, more global, more IDW, also longer form in some cases, philosophy, you know, there's a lot going on there. Check it out. Patreon.com/TMBS. Matt.
Yeah, patreon.com/literary hangover. We're in Hawthorne right now. We're going to get to some women authors. I didn't intend it for to be sort of Hawthorne and Washington Irving heavy, but that's because I'm actually working extra hard on the Catherine Maria Sedgwick and Lydia Maria Child episode. So I'm not just a bro. This isn't just bro literature, okay? But yeah, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Maypole of Marymount. I think it has a pretty astounding amount of parallels to our modern globalist cuck versus MAGA ethno-state fascist dynamic. So check it out. And we go through the entire story, so you don't even have to read it.
That's great. I really enjoyed because I do read novels, but not enough. And I've enjoyed when I've had an opportunity.
Is the Marlon James one the last one you read?
Marlon James one is the last one I read, unfortunately. Brief History of Seven Killings. I'm reading Sacred Games right now, but I did read that when that came out. I think I said it before, but there was something just so fitting about taking the train through New England, just listening to Hawthorne, even down to like Bowdoin as a historical place. And like going to Bates, and I remember all of these places. Like there's like literally like wicker chairs with like Hawthorne Hall, you know.
It's there's in the early episode of Sopranos when Tony takes Meadow up to check out Bowdoin.
Colby College.
She goes to all three.
Yeah,
she does the tour. That's the Bates, Colby Bates Bowdoin tour.
Yep, they show a Hawthorne quote in there.
Right.
Great episode.
That is a really good episode. Of course, check out Antifada, Patreon. What is that? Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Chrisman and Virgil Texas on.
Chrisman and Virgil Texas on. Lots going on, of course, in the whole MR universe. Brendan is hard at work on a Fish Sucks Patreon project.
No, but I'll plug something.
Oh, yeah, please do.
My friend, former professor of mine, Greg Ames, if we want to talk about bro literature, recently had one of his stories read at LA or SF Sketchfest by Lance Reddick of Corporate. It's called Benefactor. It's on Selected Shorts podcast.
Oh, nice.
And he's interviewed by Arpana Nancherla as well. And it's pretty funny. So I would check it
Aparna. That's a cool one. I hosted a show once where she was a co-panelist on. And hoo boy, that was a tough one. I felt very Samish. All right, everybody. We'll see you in the fun half.